KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Los Angeles firefighters caught a break with the wind. We'll reach out to an official with the Federal Emergency Management Agency to ask how soon residents can talk of rebuilding. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. We have an exit interview with a cabinet secretary in a contentious job. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Alejandro Mayorkas argues he already delivered much of the border security that Republicans promise. We'll hear the case he makes. We also meet the Republican who served as President Biden's ambassador to Turkey. And John Burnett shows how legal hemp farming in Texas flooded the state with drugs. It's Monday, January 13th. 35 years ago today, in 1990, Douglas Wilder of Virginia became the nation's first elected black governor. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The National Weather Service has issued new red flag warnings about winds in the Los Angeles area. This bulletin is called a particularly dangerous situation. Some winds could gust up to 70 miles per hour. Forecasters say the winds won't be as powerful as those that fueled the LA firestorm last week, but they could trigger explosive fire growth. Robert Clark is a fire behavior analyst for CAL FIRE.
Even though you might not see activity on our fire currently or very isolated pockets, the possibility and the ability for fires to become active or new fire starts is high probability.
The Palisades fire to the west of Los Angeles is now 14% contained. The Eaton fire in the Pasadena-Altadena area is about a third contained. California authorities say at least 24 people have died in the wildfires. Most of the deaths in the Los Angeles County blazes have come in the Eaton fire. Elise Hugh reports on two victims who perished in Altadena.
Both family members who died in the Eaton fire faced disabilities. Anthony Mitchell Sr. was a 67-year-old amputee. His son Justin Mitchell, who also died in the fire, had cerebral palsy. The family says the pair were waiting to be evacuated as flames reached their neighborhood. Hajim White is Anthony Mitchell's daughter.
I just lost it. I started screaming, hollering at my husband. He was like, what's wrong, what's wrong? I said, my dad and brother's gone.
Crews have begun search and recovery operations using cadaver dogs to locate any additional victims. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
The Senate starts confirmation hearings this week for nominees to President-elect Trump's cabinet. Trump's choices to lead the Justice Department, Defense Department, CIA, and the State Department are among the first to appear before Senate committees. NPR's Luke Garrett has more.
On Tuesday, Pete Hegseth, Trump's choice for defense secretary, will take questions from the Senate Armed Services Committee. Hegseth, a former Fox News host and combat veteran, has been meeting with senators for weeks as he faces allegations of excessive drinking and sexual misconduct. Despite this, Republican Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas tells Fox News that all of Trump's picks, including Hegseth, will get confirmed.
Yes, some of them are outside the box, but I do think we have the votes.
On Wednesday, Attorney General nominee Pam Bondi, Secretary of State nominee Marco Rubio, and CIA Director nominee John Ratcliffe all face Senate committee hearings. Once the committees advance the nominees, the full Senate will then vote on each candidate, who need a simple majority for confirmation. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
President Biden is scheduled to deliver a major foreign policy speech this afternoon at the State Department. He's expected to discuss the work he's done to strengthen U.S. ties with its allies and boost U.S. leadership around the world. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 151 points. This is NPR. South Korean authorities say they believe about 300 troops from North Korea have been killed in combat in Ukraine. They say South Korea's spy agency estimates another 2,700 have been injured. At least two North Korean troops have been captured by Ukrainian forces. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's willing to return them to North Korea if North Korea's leader helps set up a prisoner exchange. On the heels of the U.S. Surgeon General's report on alcohol, many experts support revising the current guidelines for alcohol. NPR's Allison Arbery reports scientists and doctors are reviewing the evidence to better understand the risks of alcohol.
If you choose to drink alcohol, the standard advice has long been to limit consumption to up to one drink a day for women, two for men. But many experts now say this amount of daily drinking may be too high. Dr. Ashish Didwania of Northwestern University is among them.
My guidelines would be drinking less than seven drinks a week.
Some research points to an increased risk of certain cancers, including breast cancer, with as little as 3 to 6 drinks per week. In Canada, the recommendations are that people should consume no more than 2 drinks per week to avoid alcohol-related harms. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The private space company Blue Origin scrubbed its overnight launch of its new rocket, the New Glenn. Mission managers said they're checking a technical issue. The managers kept resetting the launch clock before finally deciding to scrub the attempt. No new launch date has been set. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we have an assessment of President Biden's foreign policy by one of the few Republicans who joined his administration. First, we have an update on the Los Angeles fires, beginning with the sounds of one family's loss.
Anthony Mitchell Jr. and Hajim White lost their father, Anthony Sr., and their younger brother, Justin, in the Eaton fire. Here's the younger Anthony talking about his dad.
My dad was the type of man. He was real family orientated. Before he died, he said that got me, my kids, my brothers and sisters' kids, his niece and nephews and their kids were his treasure.
Hajim says she spoke with her father on the morning that he died.
My father called me that morning and told me it was a fire and he was having to evacuate. And he told me that he loved me and everything. And before we get on the phone, he said, baby, I gotta go. He said, a fire just made it in the yard.
Hajim says her family is feeling the loss. Her own daughters are expecting 2 girls.
My dad gave everybody a nickname. And now they will not have that pleasure of having their 2 daughters a nickname given to them by their father.
Anthony Sr. is survived by 2 of his 3 children, and 14 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren.
The fires have scorched through parts of Los Angeles that combined are a little bit bigger than the size of St. Louis, Missouri. And everyone in Los Angeles is bracing for possibly more extreme fire weather because high winds are in the forecast for today and tomorrow. Lori Moore Merrill is the U.S. Fire Administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency. She oversees efforts to fight fires like these and was recently in Los Angeles. Lori, how can FEMA prepare for the winds that are expected to arrive this morning? Has enough been done to maybe keep things somewhat under control?
You know, I think that the local departments and all of the mutual aid partners are ready for this. They are continuously fighting these fires. We've got large numbers, thousands of firefighters that have descended, not just from U.S. firefighters, but now Mexico and Canada are on the ground as well. And so the numbers of firefighters are allowing them to have a little bit of respite in shifts. And so our firefighters are exhausted, as you might imagine. But they are prepared, they know what's coming, and they're using the window they have even now to get these fires contained so that when the winds come up, that they can hopefully suppress any new ignitions.
So when that wind comes up, because it likely is going to come up and start, what's the biggest challenge for them?
The biggest challenge will be any new ignition and holding down the containment that they have. So they've got good, strong fire lines, good retardant lines around these fires. They continue to work on that, particularly on the Palisades fire, which has been particularly difficult due to heavy, heavy brush just in the interface area. And so they will continue to work these fires. Hopefully no new ignitions, but you can see that we've had over 8 fires. And so these were all separate ignitions. If there is a new ignition, they will be prepared to get on it quickly, contain it quickly, while they continue to fight the fires that are ongoing.
And you mentioned Palisades is the more trickier fire that's out there. Why? I mean, you mentioned the brush, but is it that much more difficult to contain than the others?
This one has been particularly difficult because of the heavy, heavy brush that is just right on the edge of that particular mountain there. And so it has burned into the community. It went up and through a valley and started back up a mountain. It got to a ridge line. They were able to hold it at one of the ridge lines, but the brush there has been so heavy, so the smoke has been particularly heavy. And so ongoing, these are some of the things that we are going to have to discuss, is the thinning of this, having prescribed fire on the ground so that we can reduce the fuel load. The fuel load in these fires is astronomical, and it's not just the brush, though. It is heavy structure fuel load, because this has been an urban conflagration, not an interface fire in particular. Even though it may have started in the interface, it is in the suburban communities, the urban communities. And so this is a full-bore conflagration with structure-to-structure fire spread, which that's why this was so difficult. When you have that heavy a fuel load and structures burning, now the fires are much more intense, and that coupled with wind is how we get that blowtorch effect that the firefighters struggled to get in front of in the early hours. They are now working, obviously, to contain it.
I know FEMA has hazard mitigation planning for earthquakes, floods, and hurricanes, but how much might FEMA now have to be just as involved in fire damage prevention?
That is continuing to scale, obviously. FEMA is very good at, as you said, major storms, hurricanes, floods, wind. Fire is coming along because we realize that this is the threat. And with the fuel load across the nation, we have not focused properly with putting fire back on the land. We stopped that years ago. And if we don't get some beneficial fire on the land to reduce some of the fuel load, this is going to continue. This literally could happen in any community across the nation. We saw it in the Marshall Fire in 2021 in Colorado. We saw it in the Paradise Fire in 2018. And we saw it in Lahaina in 2023. So these are conflagrations. These are not wildland fires with trees burning. These are structure-to-structure fire spread, heavy, heavy fuel load, and heavy toxic smoke and fumes that come out of these fires. So we're much better to get ahead of this and prepare, build to code, make sure we're retrofitting structures to code. And so this is how we're going to get in front of this, and we have to be able to prepare ahead of ignitions.
Lori Moore Merrill is the U.S. Fire Administrator for FEMA. Lori, thank you.
Thank you.
Just under 4 years ago, a new president spoke of a new approach to foreign policy.
American leadership must meet this new moment of advancing authoritarianism, including the growing ambitions of China to rival the United States and the determination of Russia to damage and disrupt our democracy.
President Biden emphasized stronger alliances and more adult leadership. 4 years have passed, and whether the decisions were right or wrong on the merits, foreign policy was a political weight for Biden, from the collapse in Afghanistan to the Gaza war to the war in Ukraine that most Americans support, but some Republicans now oppose. Biden's diplomatic team included Jeff Flake, a former Republican senator who for a time was the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, and he's on the line from Utah. Ambassador, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Did you feel that as ambassador you were advancing a coherent approach to the world by the Biden administration?
I did. I think that there has been, long been, a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. There's an old adage that politics stops at the water's edge. That's not completely true, but it's more true than not, and I did feel that way.
And that's an interesting thing that you say about that there has been a bipartisan consensus. Does it still feel that way to you as we have an incoming president who at least talks so very differently about other countries in the world, including U.S. allies?
Well, obviously, the new president will have his own agenda, his own feelings about foreign policy. But if you look at the Congress, and particularly the Senate, there still is that bipartisan consensus. And I think that the president's pick for Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, Mike Waltz, these are people who I think kind of share that bipartisan consensus and will move forward with it.
Michael Waltz, the National Security Advisor, you're saying that you see people there who would obviously not agree with Biden on some big issues, but they have the basic idea of American security that is grounded in alliances around the world. Is that right?
You bet. They value, in particular, our NATO alliance. That's been the most successful military alliance in history. Obviously, in the Indo-Pacific, we need alliances. We have them with the Quad, with AUKUS. So I think that we're in a good position.
I mentioned that you spent some time as ambassador to Turkey. We've just in recent weeks, and you've watched a collapse next door in Syria. A rebel group came to power, deposed the old government. President-elect Trump says Turkey is behind this, that they've wanted Syria for a long time, and that the rebels are, quote, controlled by Turkey. Do you believe that the rebels are, in fact, controlled by Turkey?
Well, Turkey does have tremendous influence with the rebel group. It is true that we're in a much better position. The Syrian people are in a much better position with Assad gone. Obviously, we'll want to work with our ally Turkey and to ensure that the people of Syria can exercise freedom of religion and freedom of, well, all the freedoms that they deserve that they've been denied for so long. And I'm convinced we're in a much better place than we were before. Iran is significantly weakened, and that will be to everyone's benefit.
Oh, well, that raises a very interesting point as well. Israel, whatever you think of their various actions, has devastated one Iranian proxy or ally after another. And finally, at the end, the Syrian government, another Iranian ally, collapsed. Is there some opportunity in this moment in the way the United States approaches or confronts Iran? And if so, how would you frame that opportunity?
Well, there is tremendous opportunity. Obviously, I think the new president will move back to what he called maximum pressure on Iran. And I think that that's a good thing. If we can deny them the ability to wage war, proxy wars in the region, that'll be a good thing and good for all of our allies in the region.
And do you think that can be done without an excessive risk of war with Iran?
Well, that potential always exists, but I think it's much less likely now, given Iran's weakened position, and it is significantly weakened.
Ambassador Flake, Senator Flake, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Jeff Flake is a former Republican senator from Arizona who was later the top U.S. envoy to Turkey. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comedian Roy Wood Jr. His new comedy special, Lonely Flowers, looks at how isolation has sent society spiraling into a culture full of guns, rude employees, self-checkout lanes, and sex parties. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Information about the wonders of the universe is at templeton.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep with an update on the civil war in Sudan. The army, by which I mean the government's army, has recaptured a key city south of the capital. And that's sparking celebrations and hope of a turning point. This civil war has created the world's largest humanitarian crisis and led to famine and accusations of genocide. NPR's Emmanuel Akinmotu reports.
A rare explosion of joy in Sudan. Drummers in the breadbasket central state of Jazeera pound out rhythms on traditional copper drums. In footage posted by local Sudanese media, crowds pour into the streets of Wad Madani in celebration as troops from the Sudanese army enter the city for the first time in over a year. Since April 2023, two former allies, the army and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have battled for territory and control of Sudan. Wad Madani lies on the banks of the Blue Nile River. Controlling it allows greater access to other parts of the country. Much of Jazeera is still under RSF control, but the tide could be turning. The agricultural region has suffered some of the worst atrocities of the war, and Sudan urgently needs it to stop the famine. The RSF's leader, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, was sanctioned by the US government earlier this month, dealing a blow to his legitimacy. He vowed the defeat was just a temporary setback in a broadcast which aired yesterday. Both sides have committed atrocities during the war, but last year, the RSF accounted for almost 80% of attacks targeting civilians, according to ACLED, a non-profit specializing in conflict research. So as the RSF loses ground to the army, the celebrations erupt from Sudanese people who hope for an end to the brutality. Emmanuel Akinmotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Texas is awash in marijuana. A loophole in a law designed to allow farmers to grow non-intoxicating hemp has been exploited by chemists who figured out a way to use it to get you stoned. As John Burnett reports, some Republicans hope to pass a ban.
Today, Texas has more than 7,000 cannabis dispensaries, nearly twice as many as California. There's 24-hour cannabis delivery, cannabis vending machines, mail-order cannabis, and cannabis bake shops like Restart, a retailer in Austin.
One of my personal favorites is our Brownie Bottom Cheesecake. It has 25 milligrams of Delta-9 THC, and it is chef's kiss, in my opinion.
Delta-9 THC is a chemical in cannabis that gets you blazed. But wait, Texas never legalized recreational marijuana. What's going on?
Roll me up and smoke me when I die.
Welcome to the Republic of THC. Texas has inadvertently become the biggest, richest market for cannabis in the nation. After the state passed a law 6 years ago to encourage farmers to grow hemp for clothing and bedding, resourceful lab technicians started extracting psychoactive compounds from the plant. Although the plants look alike, marijuana is high in THC, while hemp is low in THC.
It was meant to give agriculture a new product for the market, specifically in the fiber market.
The bill's author, Republican State Senator Charles Perry, a Baptist deacon from Lubbock, never imagined his law would usher in
Everything from cannabis-infused grapefruit soda to mango lollipops. But that's exactly what it did.
I'm disappointed, but I'm not surprised. When I passed that, I said, if you guys screw this up by being cute and getting people high from it, there will be consequences.
I asked Cynthia Cabrera if she's worried about these consequences. She's chief strategy officer for Hometown Hero, the Austin-based cannabis behemoth that took advantage of the Texas loophole and also sells products across the country.
This industry is here, right? So perhaps it was unintentional and it's not what he wanted, but we're talking about eliminating 50,000 jobs and billions of dollars in revenue because someone doesn't like it.
There are actually two cannabis industries in Texas, and they're at war: consumable hemp and medical marijuana. Like 48 other states, Texas legalized medical marijuana. Under its compassionate use program, qualified consumers with conditions like MS and cancer can buy it. Nico Richardson is CEO of Texas Original, which is licensed under strict regulations to grow, process, and sell medical marijuana in Texas. But under the current loophole, there's no way his highly regulated company can compete with the freewheeling hemp shops.
From day one, we have tried to play by the rules.
What's happening to you?
And we're getting slaughtered by a completely unregulated, intoxicating hemp industry.
Richardson calls it unregulated because his own independent testing, plus an investigation by Texas Monthly Magazine, revealed that some over-the-counter hemp products far exceed the legal limit for THC. Others are contaminated with heavy metals, pesticide, and mold. And without an age limit, some hemp houses brazenly sell to kids.
There is no recreational market in the country that would allow that. Not one.
But in only 2 years, consumable hemp has earned a loyal customer base.
Don't take hemp-derived consumables away from us. Something that works. Something that helps.
Mitch Fuller is chairman of the VFW National Legislative Committee. Like many veterans, he wants access to cheap, potent cannabis to treat his PTSD from combat duty.
Don't take that option away from us. Force us into Texas Compassionate Use Program if we don't want to use marijuana.
He says Texas medical marijuana is weak and expensive. And there's even more competition from the border state of New Mexico, where recreational pot is completely legal. Dark Matter Cannabis is the largest dispensary in Sunland Park, New Mexico, minutes from El Paso, Texas. I met Danny, a Texan who was picking up some marijuana flower called Blueberry Lemon Haze for a weekend with his girlfriend. He didn't want to give his last name because New Mexico weed is technically illegal in Texas, and as a business owner, he wants to avoid trouble. Danny says he would never buy it from a dope dealer.
Now that we can come in here and just kind of pick anything, it's pretty neat. This is fun, though. It's a lot of fun.
As Texas lawmakers meet in Austin this week for their biennial session, high on the agenda will be how to rein in psychoactive hemp. The powerful Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick has vowed to pass a new bill that would ban all forms of intoxicating hemp, which would be the end of the Republic of THC. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Austin.
This is NPR News.
There's a glut of new fiction titles coming out in the next couple months, among them a book called Dream State by Eric Puchner.
It's this real interesting meditation on marriage and on like male friendships and the sort of like what-ifs in life.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We delve into a few upcoming releases, including what we know about the new Hunger Games book, on All Things Considered from NPR News. Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The National Weather Service is issuing a rare warning of a, quote, particularly dangerous situation in fire zones across the Los Angeles area. More powerful winds could deal a major setback in the massive battle to contain several wildfires that have killed at least 24 people and wiped out thousands of structures, in some cases, entire neighborhoods. Delivering an update a short time ago, Fire Chief Kristen Crowley confirmed the Palisades fire remains the largest.
This fire is now at 23,713 acres with 14% containment, with 5,123 personnel assigned to the Palisades incident.
Quick update, CAL FIRE now says a Palisades fire is 11% contained. Qatar is hosting a critical week in negotiations to end Israel's war in Gaza. Negotiators from Israel, Hamas, and the U.S. are working on a ceasefire deal. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports President-elect Trump's team is weighing in.
I spoke with an official with knowledge of the ongoing talks who's not authorized to speak publicly, but who said Trump's team has told Israel that by the inauguration, they want either a deal or a declaration of principles, which would be some kind of document that would, you know, lock the sides into a commitment toward a deal.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. From Washington, this is NPR News. South Korea's spy agency says that inexperienced North Korean troops fighting in Russia have suffered heavy casualties. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul that Ukraine claims to have taken two North Korean soldiers prisoner and interrogated them.
National intelligence officials told lawmakers that North Korea has suffered an estimated 300 killed and 2,700 wounded out of a total of about 11,000 deployed to Russia. The spy agency also said North Korea has told its troops to kill themselves rather than be taken alive. Two, at least, did not do that. Ukraine released video of two wounded soldiers being interrogated with a Korean interpreter with help from the South spy agency. President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's willing to swap the North Koreans for Ukrainian prisoners held by Russia. One of the North Korean prisoners said in the video that he wanted to return to North Korea, while the other said he'd like to live in Ukraine. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A technical problem is grounding a new 320-foot rocket from the company founded by billionaire Jeff Bezos. Blue Origin's reusable rocket called New Glenn, in honor of the first American to orbit the planet, was supposed to make its inaugural launch from Cape Canaveral, Florida, early this morning. It was scheduled to lift off with a prototype satellite. No new date has been set. The Dow is up 117 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Alejandro Mayorkas steps down 1 week from today. President Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security ends four contentious years in which Republicans accused him of failing to secure the border. When he came by our studios for an exit interview, Mayorkas made an assertion.
The border right now is more secure than it was at the end of 2019, the last year before the pandemic struck.
He says fewer people are crossing these days than during parts of the first Trump administration.
And that has been consistently the case now for approximately 6 months.
In other words, Mayorkas contends the border security that President-elect Trump promised was already delivered by the administration Trump defeated. He says the Biden administration managed a surge of migrants that peaked in 2023. Why not do that years earlier?
The answer is multi-part.
Critics blame Biden's border changes at the start of his administration, while Mayorkas points to setbacks later. Courts stopped Biden from using pandemic restrictions to turn away new arrivals, and then came negotiations with Congress for extra resources.
Which proved successful until they were politically torpedoed.
Republicans sank their own bill at Trump's urging during the election year. Biden finally acted on his own, but Trump won in November.
I don't think we prevailed in communicating to the American people successfully. The challenges of migration at an historic level since World War II.
Now Democrats hand over power to an administration that has promised more than border security. They've promised mass deportations of people here without legal status. We wanted Mayorkas' perspective on what may be coming, since he's overseen many deportations himself. How many people have you deported, say, in the last year?
I believe the number is well over 250,000, a very significant number.
Is that higher than it would have been a few years ago, then?
Yes, it is. And we have built that capacity, and we have built those processes.
And I'm just trying to think about what is necessary from a layman's perspective to have capacity. You need agents, you need courts, you need court rulings, you need airplanes in some cases, or buses. You need a country that will take them, right?
We also need facilities in which to detain individuals. We need legal personnel to represent the government in proceedings. If the administration that is coming in intends to execute on what it has articulated publicly, it will need substantial additional resources to do so.
The president-elect has talked about a mass deportation. As someone who knows the law, as someone who knows the systems, what is practical?
Well, I believe Tom Homan has spoken of prioritizing individuals unlawfully present in the United States who pose a public safety or national security risk.
He's referring to Trump's chosen border security czar. Mayorkas says Tom Homan's idea of who to deport sounds familiar to him.
That is precisely what we have been doing and have done.
I want to underline that. You're saying that they're promising to do the thing that you're already doing?
On September 30 of 2021, I issued immigration enforcement guidelines that identified categories of individuals for a prioritized enforcement effort. Individuals who pose a threat to our national security, individuals who pose a threat to our public safety, and individuals who pose a threat to our border security.
What about someone who's committed a crime? Are they automatically considered someone who poses a threat?
I think there are a number of factors. It depends on the crime. What if, for example, it's a misdemeanor that a majority of people would say doesn't necessarily constitute a public safety threat, but is nevertheless a violation of our laws? It becomes an issue of discretion.
An administration with limited resources tries to focus on the greatest threats. What is not clear is how many more people without legal status the new administration will target. For example, there's the question of mixed status families, homes where U.S. citizens live with people lacking legal status. One such person, Ricardo Ocampo Hernandez, spoke with NPR last year.
I've lived in the United States for over 32 years, and I still am undocumented.
He married a U.S. citizen, and they had three children who were citizens. Last month, NBC asked President-elect Trump what he would do with such families.
I don't want to be breaking up families, so the only way you don't break up the family is you keep them together and you have to send them all back.
In other words, the whole family should leave, including its U.S. citizens. What are the legal, practical, and moral aspects of that situation as you think about it?
So what President Biden did was he took executive action. We termed it keeping families together. We provided a path for keeping that family together. And
in the United States.
In the United States. That was thwarted in the courts.
Republican-led states sued, arguing Biden was going too far without action by Congress. And last year, a judge agreed.
And I believe in keeping families together, and we saw the very tragic results of the prior administration's family separation policy.
If you're going to keep families together, and if Congress and the courts won't let them stay, Mayorkas says the remaining option is for them to go. If the new administration keeps families together by deporting American citizens, what do you make of that?
Well, they wouldn't, the American citizens wouldn't be technically deported.
They would be agreeing to leave with their relatives.
They would be accompanying deported relatives, sometimes the very relatives upon whom they rely to live.
Would they have any legal defense against that situation?
They would not. Presumably, the removal, the deportation of the individuals would be pursuant to law. That's a very difficult choice, and some would posit in some ways an inhumane choice to compel.
Alejandro Mayorkas says it is not something the Biden administration wanted to do, but it is something a new president has said he is determined to try. Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in an exit interview, and we're going to hear more tomorrow about other parts of the vast agency Mayorkas is about to turn over to the Trump administration. Does the Secret Service have enough personnel after last year's assassination attempts? And does DHS, this giant department assembled after 9/11, even make sense? We'll hear his answers. And as one administration leaves, another is on its way into power. This week we'll be covering some confirmation hearings. And 1 week from today, we have live coverage of President Trump's second inauguration. Michelle Martin and I will co-host the coverage on video and on your public radio station, which brings you NPR News in your community. You can also listen on the NPR app or your smart speaker. This is NPR News.
Peter O'Dowd, the Palisades Branch Library burned in the massive wildfires tearing through Southern California. A librarian tells us what's next. Next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Music students have been attending the Peabody Institute since before the Civil War. They've learned classical music. The great opera singer Jesse Norman attended, as did jazz musicians and pop singers like Tori Amos. Now the conservatory is expanding its repertoire, adding a Grammy Award-winning rapper to the faculty. Lupe Fiasco will work one-on-one with students in one of the first hip-hop degrees offered by a conservatory. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Ever wondered if insects feel pain? We interact with them every day, and they're nearly 40% of all living species on Earth. Now, new research explores the possibility that insects feel this subjective experience of pain. It's known as being sentient. Science journalist Shayla Love wrote about it in The New Yorker, about what it might mean for humans if bugs can indeed feel pain.
This is very difficult to prove, right? Even in humans, to evaluate pain is really, really tricky. We have all of these pain scales where we try to rate from 1 to 10 to describe what we're feeling. And so a lot of the people studying insect pain are just doing studies to not prove that insects feel pain, but question the reasons why we think they don't. There was a really great study done by Matilda Gibbons where she challenged bees to drink from one of two feeders, and one of them was heated and the other one was room temperature. But if she increased the level of sugar in the heated feeder, she would see that the bees, only when the sugar was increased, would endure the heat in order to drink the sweeter liquid. It's really about showing that they're just not robots.
Now, if we do indeed discover that insects are sentient, I mean, what should humans do about it? Because, I mean, I'll admit, I shoo away insects all the time. And if I see, say, a black widow spider, I don't think about shooing them as much as I think about squishing them. So how do we deal with it if insects are sentient, if that indeed becomes the case?
Right. This is the normative question. Like, let's say that we can never prove it for sure, but we've raised this plausible reasoning that they might. What do we do? And many of the researchers are not in the case that we should then never kill an insect again. It's kind of impossible. But just considering the subjective experience of insects would or could change our welfare considerations for them in farming, for example. It's sort of gruesome to sit through and think about how to end their lives in a way that would be as ethical as possible, because you sort of are like, wait, if they feel something, shouldn't we not harm them at all? But that's not the case for many other animals in our world already.
Could it possibly become an us versus them scenario? So, for example, locusts that eat crops and cause damage and means that we don't have food to eat, or maybe mosquitoes that carry disease that cause human death. Could it become one of those things where it's an us versus them scenario and we decide to pick and choose what insects we decide to be careful with and ones that we decide to eradicate?
Sure. And I think that no one is saying that we should protect mosquitoes that cause disease. I think in the places that we can, and it wouldn't be detrimental to human life, considering their welfare can often go hand in hand with human goals, right? If you give black soldier flies the food that they like when you're farming them, then they might produce more eggs, which is better for farming them, right? So there are ways in which animal welfare doesn't always contradict the goals that humans have.
Considering how much you've researched this and looked into this, Shayla, how has your own view of insects evolved over time?
I was a vegan for a long time, and I'm not anymore. And this story did almost make me a vegan again. But I think another way it impacted me, besides trying to not just mindlessly squish insects if it's not necessary, is the world feels a lot more populated to me now. I went to Washington Square Park with one of the bee researchers, Lars Chitka. I felt the park around me sort of fill up with living things because I knew that we were surrounded by insects. That sense of wonder that we could just be surrounded by beings that have their own subjective experience was really cool, and something I think learning about this topic really gave me.
That was science reporter Shayla Love. You can read her story, Do Insects Feel Pain, in The New Yorker. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A court ruling in Iowa altered child abuse prosecutions. Most states allow video testimony from children who the court decides are unable to face their alleged abusers in court. They can testify by video. But over the summer, Iowa's Supreme Court blocked that practice in that state. As Iowa Public Radio's Katerina Sestarek reports, the state attorney general hopes voters will turn that decision around.
For decades, children in Iowa have been able to testify at trials through a video system from a separate room. That's in cases where therapists say children couldn't handle testifying in the presence of an alleged abuser.
And then with one ruling, all of those protections vanished.
That's Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd. According to her and the court, though we couldn't confirm it, the ruling by Iowa's Supreme Court makes it the only state that doesn't let children testify by video in such cases.
Unless something changes, we will see fewer prosecutions of crimes against children, particularly those that are brutal. Kids will be too scared to testify, and those cases will get dropped. Criminals will walk free.
Over the summer, the court ruled 4-3 that the use of one-way video testimony, where the child couldn't see the defendant, violated the defendant's right to confront witnesses. Justice David May wrote the majority opinion, saying that when the Iowa Constitution was ratified in 1857, confrontation was understood to be a face-to-face encounter. He writes that at least requires two-way video testimony, but didn't actually say if that's allowed now either. Chief Justice Susan Christensen wrote the dissent, noting that video didn't exist in 1857. She also said laws around juveniles in the justice system have changed a lot since then. The Attorney General held a press conference in December where Brittany Sauter, a survivor of human trafficking, spoke. She said she was in her late teens and didn't have the video option. She said she didn't testify because she was paralyzed with fear at the thought of being in the same room as her trafficker.
I know how important this amendment is because I've lived the alternative. I didn't testify because the system felt too unsafe for me to do so. How many more survivors will feel the same way?
Attorney General Byrd, a Republican, called on Iowa lawmakers to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot to counter the court's decision. It would give the legislature more powers over the rights of defendants to confront children or witnesses with a mental illness or intellectual disability in court. But that raises concerns for defendants' rights. Robert Rigg is a retired Drake University law professor and a founder of the Iowa Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. He says the proposal could lead to wrongful convictions. Rigg says defendants are presumed innocent and it's supposed to be hard to convict them.
Testifying in front of someone is, well, a lack of a better term, it's dramatic, it's hard, it's difficult, and it's supposed to be.
It takes approval by two general assemblies to put amendments on the ballot in Iowa, so the earliest this could face voters would be 2027. In the meantime, prosecutors say they'll keep pursuing child abuse cases and try to help kids through the courts. For NPR News, I'm Katerina Sestarek in Des Moines, Iowa.
The U.S. Surgeon General recently warned that drinking alcohol increases cancer risk. So does everyone need to give up alcohol? NPR's Allison Aubrey asked some experts.
If you choose to drink alcohol, the standard advice has long been to limit consumption to up to one drink a day for women, up to two for men. But many experts now say this amount of daily drinking may be too high. Dr. Ashish Didwania of Northwestern University is among them.
I very much agree with that, and I do think a change is needed.
Some research points to an increased risk of certain cancers and strokes, even with moderate drinking. So how much is okay? Didwania says the science does not offer up a precise answer. But after considering all the evidence, this is where he's landed.
My guidelines would be that drinking less than seven drinks a week would be a healthier way to use alcohol.
Didwania points to a review that found lower risks for people who consume no more than that. And though there's no perfect study, given how difficult it is to precisely suss out the effects of alcohol on health, much of the evidence points in the same direction.
That does translate into, okay, if I have a cocktail or a beer, I take a couple days off, I shouldn't be scared.
And he says he feels comfortable with his level of drinking.
My personal threshold for alcohol consumption would fit with this evolution of less than seven a week. I'll have one to two cocktails a couple days a week.
If you want to set your own threshold, you'll want to understand your personal risks and understand that even physicians come to slightly different conclusions about what amount of alcohol people can drink without increasing the risk of harms. Anna Lemke is a professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Her read of the evidence is that it's better to aim for fewer drinks.
If you drink no more than 1 to 2 standard drinks per week, you're probably not increasing your risk for bad health outcomes. But anything above that, and you are.
She says plenty of light drinkers do remain healthy. One explanation is that they may have other habits, such as a healthy diet and regular exercise. But all the times you may have heard that drinking red wine is beneficial, Lemke says the thinking has evolved.
Contrary to previous thinking about the Mediterranean diet or resveratrol, there's no evidence at all that drinking is healthy.
The better way to think about it is if you stay below a certain amount of alcohol, it's unlikely to be harmful, unless you've been counseled not to drink at all. Breast cancer risks may begin to increase with as little as 3 to 6 drinks a week. And Lemke says women are more susceptible to adverse outcomes from alcohol in general, perhaps due to hormones or differences in the way women metabolize alcohol. So it's best to stay below this.
If you really want to stay in the non-risky drinking zone, you would be drinking no more than 1 to 2 standard drinks per week.
So whether it's 2 drinks a week or something closer to 7, we could get more advice soon. U.S. alcohol guidelines are under review now as the consensus grows that less is better. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.